Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
So it's Thanksgiving week, John, and everyone's busy. And of course, John and I have got our own things going on. And to shorten week, it means all of our work has to get done in a few days. But we're thankful for that because we're thankful for what we get to do. We're thankful for the people who listen and read and follow our work because it's a passion, right, John?
Right. We're not doing this podcast for money.
Right. Exactly. We do it because I think it serves a good purpose, and it's stuff that gets left on the cutting room floor, so to speak, in regular, you know, capitalist driven media.
News, right.
And so I'm thankful for this outlook and this ability to do that. And with that said, we've got a really big gift for you this week, I think. We just taped this, and we're just listening to it. And I spent most of the time grinning ear to ear.
He's geeking out.
But we get the honor to sit down with the former special agent in charge of Chicago's FBI field office, Robert Grant. And he kind of pulled the veil back on a lot of the mystery and a lot of the issues that the FBI has been dealing with. Obviously, we talk about it all the time, the wide-reaching, ongoing investigation into Madigan Electric. I'm sorry.
Good one.
The various lobbying apparatuses.
Good move, my Padawan. Yeah.
But we got over an hour with Robert, and it's such a good conversation that we're going to break it into two pieces and make our work a little bit easier. So it's a gift for us too in this Thanksgiving week.
But also with, it's good to talk, to listen to him, because as the Thanksgiving holiday closes, December 9th is coming. December 9th is when Michael Horowitz, the Justice Department Inspector General, comes out with his report. And already an FBI official is getting jammed up in just one aspect of this criminal investigation. And then you're going to have John Durham. And right now, as we're speaking, the last throbs of the liberal democratic revenge fantasy is collapsing, and they're blaming cultists on the right for their collapse. It's just so weird. But to have Rob Grant talk about John Brennan and
James Clapper,
and the effect of people like Peter Strzok on the FBI. Interesting.
Really interesting. And of course, we'll dive into some way back machine about crimes in Chicago and how that stuff is all unveiled. So stay with us. It's going to be a good one.
The Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
And now we're talking to Rob Grant, who for years was a special agent in charge of the Chicago office of the FBI. He spent, I believe, 30 years in the FBI and law enforcement, and he's our guest. Hello.
Thanks, John. Happy to be here. 29 years to be exact.
29.
Yeah, I don't want to overstate it.
Now, we met again just the other day at the Lincoln Forum's panel discussion on political corruption. And we talked, the panelists were Marianne Ahern, Ben Bradley was a moderator, Dave McKinney, and Rob, and me. And we talked about the nature of the federal investigation into politics in Illinois, but some news is breaking, and I wanted to get your reaction to it. And that is, after the what I call the revenge fantasy theater of the Democrats in Washington over the Trump impeachment, news broke that an FBI official was under criminal investigation for falsifying or playing with the FISA warrant. And I wonder, now you spent your life in FBI, and I know many FBI people, agents, who are like straight and narrow guys and women, and to a man and woman, I've never seen one, met one of them who didn't revere the Constitution and was were even more careful than, say, the average person about liberty and freedom versus the, you know, federal government. And I wonder what you think about what's unfolding there with Horowitz and Durham and the investigation there.
Well, I don't know enough about the Inspector General's referral. It may be a referral that says there could have been something criminal.
Yes.
When you're putting together all the pieces of a FISA warrant, it is one of the more intensive operations with a lot of oversight from the Department of Justice and from FBI legal counsel. The nature of that investigation probably drew on sources, some of which were in the national security realm. For example, when an FBI agent comes and knocks on your door, John, and interviews you, they produce what's called an FD-302. And for your right. listeners, that's just a summary document. It's not supposed to be a transcript. And it's an issue that comes up in trials. You know, every defense counsel puts the agent on the stand, says, is this your recollection of right. the interview of my client? And, oh, by the way, for the jury's purposes, it's not a summary. This is just what you remember. It may not be exactly what. And so that, yeah. that game is played in every trial. It's not expected to be a fact-based thing. It's supposed to be done in 5 days, and in some cases it gets elongated. Then there are other reports that are done by people who work in the intelligence side. So the Bureau really kind of is broken down into two spheres, national security and criminal. Mm-hmm. And agents that work criminal cases are used to the oversight, the tension that exists in a criminal courtroom. So they're naturally, they tend to be better equipped to put down facts, try to scrub everything out of this document that has to do with any kind of bias or opinion.
No impression.
Facts, right. You know, it's facts, just the facts, just like Joe Friday used to say. On the national security side, it's a little bit different. So you're gleaning and interpreting imperfect pieces of information. And what I don't know about this particular latest development is where in the compilation of that FISA warrant they detected a departure. And who authored that departure, and a lot of it will go to, and why did they do it? Was it an honest mistake?
Yeah.
And one of the challenges we had when I was in the Bureau, and I'm sure it's still a challenge today, so the FBI pre-9/11 had no what we call intelligence analysts. So we collected a lot. We were your classic pack rat of information. We collected it, kept it in-house, and didn't really share it with the world, either local law enforcement or intelligence services, even though the FBI was a full-fledged member of the intelligence community. So one of the recognitions after 9/11 was we really needed to have people to go into that repository of information and glean what is in there that could be of value. So you might go out and do an investigation on Eastern European organized crime. And so you're out doing an organized crime investigation, and the agent involved in that investigation may not have the insight into what's going on in that country in terms of intelligence services, and maybe there's collection requirements, as we say, in the intelligence community. It's, you know, think of it as a scoreboard, a lot of zeros up there, and the National Security Council is saying we need answers to these questions. So the CIA will be tasked to go try and find answers to those questions. NSA will be tasked. The FBI will be tasked. And we all go out there amongst our areas of expertise and try to gather that to kind of clarify for the president and for the National Security Council, you know, these particular issues. So what happens in the post 9/11 period is we bring in a lot of intelligence analysts come from the military, from CIA, NSA, wherever. They're very good at what they do, but they've never been in a hybrid environment like the FBI's, where what you write and what you say could show up in a courtroom. So the CIA, when it writes, isn't writing.
They're writing for one person.
They're writing for one person. And sometimes it's based on impressions. Their training has to tell them that. Hmm. Sources are a classic example. This is what happened, is you might have an intelligence analyst who finds information from John Cass, the FBI agent, who has a human source, Jeff Carlin over here, who's provided a piece of information. So he writes it down, puts it in a report. Intelligence analyst looks over the shoulder of that reporting and says, hey, this piece of information shares can answer a question to the National Security Council. But the response by the intelligence analyst is to characterize Jeff as a source. So when Jeff is going to go into the criminal case and get up on the stand, and then in the backdrop is this intelligence analyst's assessment of Jeff as a source, maybe totally uncredible. I mean, they may actually say that, you know, this person is not credible in this area.
Right.
Defense counsel wants that to impeach Jeff as a source in the criminal case. So that natural tension between what you can do in a criminal case and what you do as art, not science, in the intelligence world sometimes can come in conflict. And that might be part of what is happening here. My guess would be the IG made the referral out of an abundance of caution. It'll be up to the Department of Justice to decide whether or not the intention here was to materially mislead, whether there was ill intent. I have a hard time thinking that. I could see human error before I could see deliberate intent, but that's for the DOJ and the IG to figure out.
But we do see deliberate intent, or at least bias, not among I don't know what the terminology is, line agents or people in the field, people in Chicago, people, you know, FBI agents and officials.
Guys with the brown butcher paper that they put up in the windows.
Right, the ones that I like that do the brown butcher paper. But we did see, you know, the texts that were released from Lisa Strzok, or what is it?
Lisa Page
and that Strzok. But what's your general impression of all that? Because all that's coming back to us now with John Durham tasked to investigate criminally with the Horowitz report. What's your, as a longtime FBI official, what's your general feelings about that kind of stuff that you heard and we all heard? You
know? Well,
like you can smell them you can smell the Trump supporters in the Walmart, and we're going to get them, and we have insurance policies and all that.
Well, it was a lack of discipline on Pete Strzok's part, without question. But to assume that FBI agents and FBI personnel don't have strong feelings about politics, they certainly do.
Yes.
But are they professional enough to keep that at the door and not let it infect their work? That's the key. Because everybody, they vote like everybody else does. And unfortunately, they also have a lot of knowledge about political figures that sometimes the rest of the public doesn't. So they have very strong opinions about people's ethics, people's morals, people's past. They can't share with anybody, but that can drive their voting patterns. It can drive their passions. This world we have now where people are, you know, communicating real time is a real challenge to anybody in law enforcement, in that you can sometimes be documenting your personal feelings that may have had nothing at all to do with what you did. So making a connection, when Pete Strzok made that comment about, you know, we have an insurance policy, that certainly is a red flag of, did that infect your work? You know, and did that affect your what you were doing and why you did it? And it's a very legitimate area of inquiry. And I think, I don't want to speak to Durham's investigation. The two guys working with him are two good friends of mine, very good at what they do. They're both retired, been retired for a while. And I've known them my whole career. I think what he's focused in on, and I think what the Attorney General initially laid out was, when you get into domestic surveillance, like my domestic terrorism team here in Chicago, for the common world, domestic terrorism is not like international terrorism. International terrorism is codified in law. Domestic terrorism is more categorically something imprinted by the FBI. So the KKK would be a domestic terrorist group and other groups like that. But they're not designated by an official body that says, okay, like State Department determines who's an international terrorist group, and that opens the door for the FBI to investigate those anybody associated with those groups. But domestically, we don't have that same apparatus, so we have to separate those. And every time the FBI has gotten in trouble in its 100-plus year history, it's always been in this area of being overly aggressive in the domestic space. You know, threats to the country, threats to the Constitution, threats to the administration in some people's views. So the investigations of Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement, the investigations of anti-war protesters were driven by a White House. Let's be clear about that.
Yes.
Who always keeps distance from these activities.
Right.
Basically says, I want to know who's behind this. I want to know it's being funded by the Communist Party in Russia and China. And they're sapping our democracy, and they're sapping our will to fight in Vietnam. So the
even
FBI
even if history calls them liberal icons.
You got it. So
the same brothers that wanted to know what Martin Luther King was doing. Right? I'm just saying.
It's all about let's go find out. So right. The issue, you know, dating for a lot of people, but the issue was the civil rights movement and the Vietnam war protests in the view of people who were virulently anti-communist and anti-Soviet Union and thought that was a threat to our democracy, which is kind of, in all these years past, people forget this how this world was constructed back then.
Sure.
They want to know who's behind it and is there money flowing in there? Is it being influenced? Maybe not knowingly influenced.
Legitimate questions.
Yeah, same like Russia messes around in our elections.
Right.
It's the same old, different vehicle, but same old issue. And that is, who's influencing our opinions and our environment? And is there a foreign adversary behind this that's providing money, direction, things like that? And it could come in the face of somebody like John Cass walks in and says, I'm willing to fund your protests. Here's $50,000. Right. But nobody knows that John Cass is connected to a Soviet agent. It's that same old era. And that tension space, when the FBI is asked to go find out, you're talking about freedom of assembly, freedom of dissent, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, all those constitutionally protected liberties that we enshrine in our Constitution to keep the mob from taking them away from us.
Which is why we opened up where I said most law enforcement people are extremely cognizant of these issues, the freedom of assembly, the freedom of speech. They're concerned. They don't want to see the federal government. They know what it can do, and they don't want to see, in my mind, many of them, the good people that I know, don't want to see it misused, and they're cautious about it.
Your articles and the articles of other writers are what we call one source of information for FBI agents, and they look at it. But there's always a point of, does it appear to be we're surveilling John Cass and the news media? No, we're gathering information from publicly available information. If John Cass goes down on the public street and starts giving a speech, do we have a lawful right to be in that space to listen to what he has to say? Because it's one thing for me to be Rob Grant, private citizen, listen to John Cass' speech. It's another thing for Rob Grant, FBI agent, to be there writing down what John says. It has all the appearances of the KGB. So that tension point is where the FBI has always gotten itself in trouble. And I think if John Durham is driving into this investigation based on what Attorney General Barr said, it's did they follow the rules that were put in place post-Watergate, post all the revelations?
Right.
Are they following the rules? Are they being overly aggressive again? And if they are, you know, who's at fault? Is it the FBI? Is it the intelligence community?
I think that there'll be many people questioned in this. Mm-hmm.
I just don't understand.
Maybe we do, son. Don't think you have a corner on all of virtue vision in the country, or that everybody else is fat and selfish and you're the first generation to come along that's felt dissatisfied. They all have, you know, about different things, and most of them didn't have the same opportunity and freedoms that you do. Let's talk poverty. Most places in the world, that's not a problem. It's a way of life. And rights? They're liable to give you a blank stare because they may not know what you're talking about. The fact is, more people are living better right here than anywhere else ever before in history. So don't expect us to roll over and play dead when you say you're dissatisfied. It's not perfect, but it's a great deal better than when we grew up. I don't know. Maybe part of it's the fact that you're in a hurry. You've grown up on instant orange juice. Flip a dial, instant entertainment. Dial seven digits, instant communication. Turn a key, push a pedal, instant transportation. Flash a card, instant money. Shove in a problem, push a few buttons, instant answers. But some problems you can't get quick answers to, no matter how much you want them. So hang in. Don't try to build a new country. Make the old one work. It has for over 400 years, and by the world's standards, that's hardly more than yesterday.
We had Andy McCarthy on a few weeks ago. He wrote The Ball of Collusion. You know, you may know of him. And he talked to us specifically about a meeting that took place right before President Obama left office. And then after the meeting involved Clapper and Brennan, Comey, who you know, and others.
I know all those guys.
Right. And then to memorialize it, 20 minutes after the inauguration, Susan Rice wrote a memo, still in the White House, saying everything was done by the book. And I'm just telling you, as a street reporter from Chicago, when I see like bureaucrats saying everything was done by the book, you might as well put like bells on it and neon signs flashing. Look here, look here, look here.
It does have the appearance of somebody attempting to say, we're not going to demonstrate here the true intention of this meeting, but we're certainly covered our ass, pardon my French. And when somebody says, let's take this question offline, or let's not document this, or keep this all confidential, those are all lightning rods to further inquiry and further investigation, without question.
So you know Comey, and you know Clapper and Brennan. What's your impression of these men? Because we get different impressions from media and from their own mouths.
And I would even want to get to narrow that down a little bit. What's your impression of these guys? Because they have obviously a civilian life now, where their goal is to make money. Whereas as they're working under the bureau, their goal is to preserve freedom and safety of their country. Do you your opinion of these guys kind of change a little when you see them going out there and being, a civilian? Do you think differently about them, or is it just, hey, they're a civilian now, they can do what they want?
Well, I like Jim Comey. I like him to this day. Did Jim Comey make mistakes? I think the collective wisdom of the FBI would say, yes, he did. And why he did it, Jim Comey can answer that question. I share his concern that the Department of Justice was conflicted, without question, and so he's left in a very difficult spot. So,
you mean after the Attorney General met with Bill Clinton in the tarmac on the airport, talked only about their grandchildren?
That doesn't pass the red face test in my mind, and right. I think it probably didn't pass Jim Comey's red face test. And says, regardless of what you may represent in terms of what that meeting on tarmac was, the President of the United States and Attorney General don't find themselves by accident on the tarmac without somebody arranging that. That's a whole area of investigation in my mind.
Yes.
So did Jim Comey might have made mistakes. He might have made mistakes. Looking around the inside of Washington and looking, these are roles that normally the FBI director does not play. So I think most people in the FBI would have said if it had been Bob Mueller there instead of Jim Comey, Bob Mueller would have written the report, sent it over to the department, said, your ball. You now defend it. You now defend the decision. It's your decision to make.
Correct.
Jim, for whatever reason, chose a different path. And so I can't speak to all the difficulties he had in doing that. James Clapper, I got to know when I was the DNI rep here in the Midwest, Director of National Intelligence. So, Director of National Intelligence, when he came on board, was trying to figure out domestically, because a lot of these people come from intelligence backgrounds, and they're outwardly looking outside the United States, and they have no concept or understanding of how information is collected in the United States, who collects it, how it's disseminated, how it works, what the threats are. And the FBI and its partnerships in law enforcement really are that piece. And for example, terrorism, we used to say it's the 22-year-old police officer that roams the neighborhood, that knows the neighborhood, who's going to be more likely to identify a risk before it emerges than an FBI agent, using a wiretap or a national security wire. So our key after 9/11 was to push out information to those 22-year-old police officers so that instead of just looking for drugs and violent crime, they add a third bucket. Do you have radicals? And I don't mean radicals in the sense of don't like the government, but radicals in the sense that they become a violent threat. So Jim Clapper, I always felt, was a very honest, hardworking man. I still feel that way. John Brennan, I'm from the old school. The CIA is to be heard from through official channels, but not on TV, not in social media, not on talk shows. And I think he's done a lot of damage to himself and to the agency. And I bet you inside the agency, I think Gina Haspel is probably saying, I wish John Brennan would just get off TV and not create this. He is exposing the reality of the Pete Strzok comment, and that is people have personal opinions.
Correct, but and I know many people, in full disclosure, I have a relative, close relative, who's a career State Department official. People have opinions, and they might complain about it with their colleagues. They don't complain about it with their families. I don't hear it, all this happened, that I never hear that. I'm sure, knowing you for so many years, you didn't go home and talk to your brother-in-law or your cousin and say, I can't believe this happened or that. You just kept it in-house, right? among people that had security clearance. You didn't get on Twitter and say it.
No, you're exactly right. In fact, my daughters and my wife would probably tell you that they learned more about what I was doing by watching TV and the reporting, because I never talked about my work when I went home. Part of it was because I was inundated with it 24/7. I wanted at least a break from it.
Right.
But I tend to think the facade sometimes works. So the FBI has a facade, the CIA has a facade, and the more you expose the human frailties inside those organizations, the more you diminish people's respect and possible confidence in the unbiased nature of the organization.
That's what's dangerous, because going back to that meeting that happened, that McCarthy, I think, appropriately targeted, that is, the danger is when people lose confidence in their institutions. And the enemies of the United States have always wanted Americans not to have confidence in those institutions. And that's to me the danger. What my fear, and I'd like to know because you've gone after terrorism, my fear is that it'll be seen ultimately, could be seen, as a political overreach by people who thought they knew more than the people who made their decision on election day. And as a result, there'll be a backlash. I don't want to see CIA or FBI, especially the counterterrorism people, lose the tools they need to do what they have to do.
You remember after 9/11, they passed the Patriot Patriot Act.
And yeah.
Patriot Act was really, although some people said it was done in a rush, those were tools that were sitting on the shelf waiting to be authorized by Congress, who for years did nothing. And it took 9/11 for them to actually look at what people have been asking for a long time. So a lot of those tools were in the national security environment already, but had never been applied to terrorism. And all we basically said was, we've been telling you, we need these tools to get to this kind of a risk.
Right.
And so it passed. And it was very successful, very controversial. I can't tell you how many meetings I went to where people would just rail against the Patriot Act. And librarians, I remember my first visits to Congress 6 months after I came here, I had to go visit all the members of Congress and that are from this area and kind of introduce myself and talk about different things. And they all talked about how aggressive the librarians were in lobbying Capitol Hill. They were parked outside everybody's door. And they were, you know, I picture a librarian as, you know, a really smart lady sitting behind the desk helping you find a book, but they're very aggressive lobbyists.
Yeah. Right.
And there's a history of the tension between the FBI and librarians, because we used to find Soviet agents going in and doing research.
Sure.
And that research, the way intelligence works, isn't about, you know, stealing something and catching them. You know, you never want to arrest a spy, because all their news replace them with somebody else, and you got to figure.
You want to watch years. Them.
Right. You want to watch them. Watching them tells you what they're interested in, and what they're interested in tells you how to vector your defensive capability against those things they're looking at. And what better place to go than to follow them to a library and find out what books they've been reading? Now, we're not worried about what books you're reading, John.
Right.
But that Soviet spy, you know, that fingerprint on the page about how a nuclear device could be constructed could be very, very valuable. But when librarians say, we don't want you doing that, there's a tension point there between us. And in fact, before I came to Chicago, we had a librarian destroyed a record here when we said we're coming back with a subpoena, because she wouldn't accept a national security letter.
Right.
So the agents went back and got a grand jury subpoena. By the time they came back to the librarian had destroyed the record. So
it wasn't like they were reading the biography of Barry Goldwater or anything, right?
They might be, but it may just be in a stack of which one book in particular is of most interest.
Right. Thermonuclear devices.
But right. this space, I think, is where you know, you want the facade of the FBI to be a facade where people have trust and confidence that it's going to be unbiased and objective. The CIA, you want them to be smart, but it's like The Office. I had John Miller, who's now the head of counterterrorism in New York. John was head of the FBI's public affairs division, his former reporter, as you know. Well, John called me when I was the SAC here and said, hey, Rob, I got a great idea. I got somebody who wants to do a reality-based TV show on the FBI, and we want to base it in Chicago. And I just had two questions for him, two things. John, why?
Right. What are you smoking?
And he goes, well, we want to show the hard work of the FBI, build confidence in the FBI. And then why Chicago? And well, Chicago had a great reputation.
Yeah.
Very, very solid office, very well run. It had nothing to do with me. I just happened to be sitting on top of the cake. But then I told him, are you absolutely nuts? And he was stunned by that. And I said, look, if you want to make it a comedy-based, reality-based TV show, it's great. I said, but we're like Hollywood. We like that facade.
Yeah,
that what you don't know is going on in there. We know everything. You know, it's amazing how many people think I know everything.
Yes, sure.
Yeah,
that's part of the leverage, though.
It works. It works when we debrief spies in New York. They would turn to two agents and say, "I know you've been following me for a long time." And of course, the two agents are scratching their head, going, "You know, I was in the Holland Tunnel last night, and you were at a birthday party with your kid, and we had no other resources." But you don't tell them that. You just nod and say, mm-hmm.
You give that FBI face.
Yeah, sure. What would you like to now tell us about all the things we've been watching? You know, so it's so that facade works for us. But from a comedy standpoint, I mean, the FBI has a lot, as does the agency, has a great sense of humor. I said, John, you're nuts. I'd rather have the public believe the myth and not see the reality.
Speaking of the great sense of humor, okay, I just got a friend of mine, Chuck Gowdy, at WLS, right? WLS TV. He goes out to, I think you were the special agent in charge, but this happened in Las Vegas, so it's not your fault. But Chuck Gowdy goes out, Las Vegas. Some preacher took a 15-year-old girl on a trip. Okay? It was one of those. And so they're in a motel room, and they finally find them. FBI gets them in a motel room in, you know, what's that act where you take underage girls across state lines? The Epstein Act or whatever it's called. And so they find him in the hotel room. The rest girl goes back. Chuck goes flying out there, goes to the room. It's already been cleaned, you know, and it's been, you know, the evidence tape is down, so it's no longer a crime scene. But someone had left a condom wrapper in a basket. And so the cameraman zooms in on it, zooms out. That was the basis.
He put that on TV?
They put it on TV. And I was just thinking about some FBI agent in Las Vegas, two guys laughing their ass off. I'm just saying.
Oh,
so
yeah.
There's, you know.
It's actually a crime scene, like when planes crash. The natural reaction of people who have to do it's a crime scene initially, and they have to recover body parts. Is about 24 hours of depression by the people working it. It's so tragic.
Sure.
It migrates into humor, dark humor.
Yes.
And the psychologists told us that that's natural. That's how you deal with the tragedy that unfolds. So you have people who one day are operating one way, and the next day are. They're, you know,
joking about marshmallows.
Marshmallows.
And, yeah. You know. I've seen it too with reporters and cops.
Madam Librarian.
Well, our special thanks to Rob Grant, former special agent in charge of the Chicago office of the FBI. He spent 29 years in the FBI, and we're going to be talking to him again. And Jeff Carlin, of course, my buddy. Executive producer of the WGN's Rokon Show with Anna DeVellantis. And me, John Cass. Husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune and a member of its editorial board. And you know who we're thankful for? We're thankful for all of you. We're thankful to Almighty God first and then to all of you for sticking with us. As unforgivable. Talk to you next time. Any talking out loud with any librarian, such as